My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guests are brothers with a shared passion for aircraft and engineering. An incident in the mid-90s changed their lives forever. At this point, their passion became their purpose. We speak business, supporting the military, trauma, and the importance of family. A Bremont special, Nick and Giles English, this is Declassified. So, childhood, we'll take you right back to childhood.
Yeah.
Was it an adventurous time for you guys growing up?
Oh, amazing time. We were so lucky. My father was, he was just this sort of passionate individual who loved going and discovering things. So it really was very exciting childhood.
Yeah.
That kind of almost semi-bohemian lifestyle where both parents were willing to give us immense amounts of responsibility, which I can only hope and give my kids in the same way. Mm. But that let us go off on these incredible adventures without, you know, with, can you please call back, you know, once a week, make sure you phone in, and off we'd go in a sort of 1940s aeroplane or something, head off around Europe.
And what age was that?
Well, we sort of, I could fly when I was 17, so the same age that the legally able, and Dad had this little old plane in the back of the garden that we used to sort of take off from. But I mean, he built a boat we went and lived on as kids. He played in a bluegrass band, so built all his own banjos. He was just one of these sort of slightly intense. He would go and specialise in something. And you were sort of along with the ride him. But it was a lovely childhood.
What was the boat then? So they built a boat. Did you live on it?
Yeah, for
we sailed from sort of England to Africa and around the Mediterranean and stuff, and just missed a load of school and off we went, which is great. Very bonding. Very, actually, as a family, it's incredibly bonding. Living on a boat in such close confines is quite an experience.
Who is he in the family? So at that point?
So at that point we had only one sister. We've now got two sisters. But
which I think was probably, part of that trip.
Consequence of the trip.
I think it happened at the end. There's four of us.
Yeah. And then have you always been close growing up as well?
Yes, no, we have. Yeah, no, we're very lucky as a family. We don't all live as close as we'd like. You know, our sisters are down in West Sussex and we're more sort of Oxfordshire way, but we do keep in touch a lot, which is fantastic.
Mm. Is there any kids in the family?
I've got three daughters, and Nick, you've got...
I've got three as well. Well, two daughters and a son, but we've both got twins as well. So you can
I've got twins as well.
Have you?
Have you?
Fantastic. There's something in the water.
It's so easy before twins came along.
brilliant. And then we went to... For following schooling, so you had a bit of a kind of university of life going with your dad and all the adventures. But then uni came. What did you study at university?
So I went off to... I studied engineering with naval architecture. I always wanted to design boats. So I went off to Southampton and did that, which was incredibly complex. I'd never done anything quite so hard as... Yeah, I thought I was going to be designing some pretty pictures of boats, and I did 3 years of stress calculations on the off bulkheads of supercarriers. And so it's very, very mathematical, but a brilliant place to be in Southampton because you had the sea. And then I was sponsored with the RAF and all the air squadrons, so did a lot of flying down there as well. So a brilliant time.
Mm. I did sort of geography and sort of historical geography, so I was... But I was a bit like Giles, we were both sort of sponsored through university, but doing a lot of flying. So I did more flying than anything else, which is great. And I recommend that to anyone to go off and join the university air squadrons and muck around doing that. It's
So Nick got a first, though, so I just think he spent the whole time working, whereas I definitely
didn't. No, it's because of the subject I picked. Always pick a subject. Wise words from our father, pick a subject you can do.
Yeah, that passionate about.
It makes life easy, doesn't it?
Yeah. Why was flying so important at this point?
Well, I think our dad's sort of restored old aircraft. He was ex-RAF. We grew up around all my dad's friends were pilots. And he, in the early days of the sort of late 70s, 80s, he was displaying World War II aircraft. And there weren't many around at that time. So every weekend he used to go off around the UK flying, and just us as kids used to go and sit in the back. And those days you did the whole air show sitting in the back of the plane.
We're too small to anyone for the CAA to see us, we'd be sort of...
You couldn't even look out. But you used to go and land at Mildenhall and all these great big American air bases and go and eat some burgers and that you'd never seen before. It was a brilliant experience. So we did that. So it was just a big family passion.
Because his two passions really were making things. Yeah. So we spent a huge amount of time as kids in the workshop with him, tinkering old bikes, cars, planes, and that's where the clocks and watches came in as well. And the other passion was flying. So the fusion of those two sort of ended up sort of determining where we went off to do later on in life. But we're then lucky enough in our kind of late teens, we both learned to fly at quite a young age and then got into the flying of old aircraft and then display flying and sort of followed our father's path a little bit there. Mm.
Could you talk about your dad for a bit? When was he in the RAF?
No, so he did 6 years with Cambridge with flying with the Air Force. So he got his wings and stuff, but then met my mother. And he always wanted to go off and be a test pilot, and she put the either them or me type conversation down.
He's a doctorate in aeronautical engineering from Cambridge, so he had a brain the size of a house, but had this of... Most people who are academic like that aren't necessarily good pilots as well, but you have that mix. But I think, our mother didn't really like the idea of him going off, becoming a test pilot or doing something like that.
And what did he do for a living?
So he was an engineer and had various engineering businesses, but an entrepreneur, which again, that entrepreneurial spirit sort of lives on a little bit. I read somewhere the other day that I think if your parents are entrepreneurs, a sort of 60% more likelihood that you'll go off down the entrepreneurial route as well, because you live and breathe that. Mm. And you're chatting about business, you're chatting about going off and taking risks and things. So he had everything from electronics business to, he would go and re-roof the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. It was incredibly, whilst writing software and doing other stuff. So he just had his fingers in a few pies, and then restoring aircraft as well. So
was that part of then, the risk taking, or like the calculated,
educated risk? I like to call it.
Okay, yeah, and the fact that that's how he brought his children up. It sounds as well.
He used to give you your pocket money a year in advance in one lump sum,
which Giles used to blow on a guitar in 2 seconds.
Exactly. I mean, we're not far from Tottenham Court Road here. Perfect place for buying guitars, but. He gave you this responsibility, and you either completely messed it up or delivered on the back of it. But his life changed when he was about 38, 39, where he got cancer. And suddenly, for him, he couldn't work anymore. He didn't want to. So he retired very young.
Well, he could work.
He could work.
It just changed his whole attitude to life. And he retired. He could retire. But he just, again, this whole thing about life was suddenly short. So, I mean, he got his medical back flying very quickly but started doing more display flying and building stuff and built airplanes. But it did affect him, didn't it, massively.
Did it affect you guys growing up?
Yeah, it sort of did a bit, because you had your dad, who was an amazing skier and all this sort of sporty guy, who suddenly
had his vulnerability, didn't he?
Yeah, suddenly he became vulnerable, and your dad's not vulnerable. He's this sort of hard guy who doesn't show that side of him. And when he got that cancer, he was definitely a changed man for a few years. Luckily, I mean, it's interesting, he says flying always saved him on that side. He's pushing a plane out, and he had kidney cancer, and he really stressed trying to push this plane out of a hangar, and went back and started...
It ruptured,
started weighing blood. And he said, pushing that plane out saved his life, because he caught it very early and they cut his kidney out, and it didn't spread. But I just think he suddenly felt he was vulnerable then. And it was only 10, 11 years later that he actually died in his plane crash. But it was amazing that period from that, because he retired from work and just spent his time building even more things.
And also what was quite sweet, our little sister, who's 12 years younger, sort of came out at 1984, I think, and he ended up spending 10 amazing years with her before he died. So she remembers these, you know, not a huge amount because she's only 10 when it happened, but had some very, her informative years were spent in very, very close relationship with her father, which is brilliant.
I mean, not many people get that opportunity.
No,
to do
no,
that.
I think, and he was sort of, he suddenly, it rejuvenated him after the operation and stuff. So he suddenly was doing lots of stuff with her as we're off at university and things, which was lovely.
Should we take you then to the 4th of March, 1995? Nick, you was in the aircraft with your dad, is that right?
Yeah, so Giles and I were sort of working up to, I guess, the next display season. I hadn't flown with dad for quite a few months, actually. And we were flying an old airplane called a Harvard or T-6 Texan. It's an American sort of fighter trainer. And it was 1942 aircraft. And we're part of this team called the Harvard Formation Team. And we'd go off and do formation aerobatics and formation flying. And this dad called me up and Giles, and he said, it's a beautiful day, 4th of March. And he said, look, haven't flown for a while. Why don't we meet at Northwild, which is an airfield, M25, M11, that sort of area. Old Battle of Britain airfield, very famous aircraft, airfield. And we, Giles and I, went up to fly with him, and we had a briefing on the ground. Giles was waiting to go up in the next sortie. I went off flying with, there's another aircraft alongside with a friend of mine flying, who we've flown with, Giles and I have flown with for many, many years. And, something went wrong. Wrong positioning of aircraft, or I mean, it's all up for speculation, but we ended up crashing. It was a pretty devastating.
What was it like to be in the aircraft when it was going on? Was your dad in front?
No, I was flying. I was in the front, dad was in the back. Do you know, it's a weird thing because we hit the ground, obviously, dad died, I broke, you know, tens and tens of bones and things, and was a bit messed up. But I can't remember the last 20 seconds of what happened. I remember lying in the field. I remember being alert. I remember asking where my father was. I remember being, you know, I suppose delirious with pain because your limbs are all over the place. And but the point is, I think your brain has, I'm sure this is the same with any accident in the military world, but your brain has this ability to almost protect you from trauma, I believe. And for the last 20 seconds, why can I not remember the last 20 seconds? I can remember getting in the airplane. I can remember lying in the field. But that 20%, that 20 last seconds of trauma as we were in this inverted spin going down to the ground, I can't remember. I can't remember. And you start trying to piece it together because there were eyewitness accounts of what happened. You think, oh, perhaps I did remember, but you don't. But I do remember lying in the field, and I do remember taking off. But poor old Giles was on the ground waiting to do the next sortie. So Giles just heard all happen over the radio, which is even worse. And
when did you find out? Giles, we'll come on to you in a sec. But when did you find out your dad had died?
So lying in the ground, obviously I was. Had lots of holes and bits and bobs lying there. I remember, it's an amazing story. So I was found by a couple of people. One was a guy who contacted us sort of 5-10 years ago and said, are you the Nick English who were in the field in Maldon and Essex in 1995? Because he was a 15-year-old kid on a cycle ride and saw the whole thing happen and came out to try and help. And then there's also a doctor playing golf in the nearby field at the golf course. So he came to help as well. And I remember asking them, you know, how's my father? How's my father? And at that point they said, look, it's fine. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about it. And as soon as someone says, don't worry about that, you know instantly that something is not right. Rather than he's fine, he's just over there. So I knew at that point pretty much.
But when you came on intensive care, weeks later, you were still asking the question, is dad alive? So, yeah, the consciousness, it all sort of comes back later on.
Well, I suppose you just lose time, don't you? You don't really know where you are.
Had you been going from the field you was in?
Yeah.
What was the process then after?
So, I mean, that's quite an interesting story in itself. So I was... So lying in the field, 999 was called, and I suddenly, hearing this 99 call, 999 call was it was a jolly, it was a helicopter with six consultant doctors flying out of Wattisham or something like that, and military guys who were just from the RAF, from the air, you know, from the army and so forth. One was a consultant doc. I mean, it was an incredible bunch of guys who heard these Mayday calls, and they landed within about 5 or 10 minutes and gave me some first aid, which I talked to one of the guys afterwards, and they didn't think I was going to make it at that point. But then also hearing the Mayday calls was the air ambulance, which Charles and I now have something in common, and he'll get onto his story in a minute.
Yeah.
And they diverted and landed and took me to the Royal London in Whitechapel. So yeah. I was taken by... There's no way I'd have survived if it had not been for them.
Oh, really? So although the aircraft put you in the situation, an aircraft took you out of that situation as well?
Oh, no, there's without a shadow. I mean, that's...
And Whitechapel is the number one A&E unit in the world, I visited there the other day, and there are loads of ex-military guys or on secondment training with the because of all their experience.
But they're used to trauma, aren't they?
Getting Nick in there, had he have gone to a local hospital, there's no way he would have survived.
Mm. It's either there or Cheltenham General, I imagine. So I probably wouldn't have made it in an ambulance.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way because I was in intensive care within a very short period of time. So.
I think you went through 12 body loads of blood.
Yeah, 90 pints of blood, I think I had. Yeah.
So all his body started reacting.
Was that initially, was the trauma injury bleeding? What was the catastrophic stuff going on there?
So the airplane did sort of three tumbles on the ground. The cockpit broke open and I was thrown out. So I was found, 20, 30 yards away from the airplane. My father stayed in, and the airplane, the wings caught on fire and other bits. So I was thrown out, but throwing out, I got ripped open by the bodywork of the airplane, the fuselage. So I got lots of big cuts and things. Break compound fractures, but also landing in a field, I got so much dirt, so much ploughed field and soil in my body that... it took, I think, them quite a lot of hours to clean the wounds out. And obviously there's some big, deep gashes, lost all my calf muscle and all this sort of thing. And I think the worry was that your kidneys would fail. And because they're trying to filter this blood with, rubbish in it, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So
there's so much bacteria.
So again, I've been trying to give blood ever since, but they won't let me, I think, because I think you're crossed off the list, aren't you, once you've had transfusions and everything else. So, I certainly wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Whitechapel.
Charles, can you remember the moment?
Yeah, I was, as Nick said, I was on the airfield, which was a couple of miles away, listening to it happen, and because the other aircraft putting out Mayday calls. And I didn't know it was Nick and Dad straight away, but I had this nasty feeling. And then as the other aircraft came back in, I knew it was Dad and Nick. And the talk on the radio was, Harvard had gone in ball of flames. And I just assumed they'd both died straight away. And... within about probably 15, 20 minutes, I heard a helicopter had been on the ground and picked someone up. I think I did know as Nick had been taken. I'd been told Dad had died. And suddenly you're sort of, it's a smack. You're on the ground. I was a 21-year-old kid who was alone in the world because... Yeah, you're in this airfield in the middle of nowhere. What happens next? And so I remember calling my mother and telling, having to tell her that Dad had died, and Nick was unlikely to make it. And I've always learned that, you know, when you're giving someone bad news, always prepare them for it. Because I literally said, "Look, Mum, Dad's died." I didn't give her that preparation. I think she's never quite recovered from that. And then I called, obviously, my father's parents, my grandparents, and told them, but trying to get my sisters to say, "Look, Nick has been taken into hospital. Get there quickly." And suddenly the weight of the world is on your shoulders. But the glimmer of hope I had was that Nick hadn't died. And there's this faint chance that he could survive. And that is this sort of, that's something to hold on to. And I think when you're when you're going through trauma, everyone around you acts very strangely as well. People don't quite know how to act with you. It's a strange period to go through. But there was always this glimmer.
You spoke then about speaking to your mum. Your youngest sister is 10.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking to my children now, who are younger, but a 10-year-old having to speak and tell them that the dad had died, especially if they were close.
Well, I had that was my next day's duty, because I went to Whitechapel that evening, and Hannah had just been left with my younger sister, with a babysitter, so she hadn't been told that Dad had died. So I went to hospital that night, spent with Nick, and then drove to Norfolk that night, got back at sort of 4 a.m, lay in Mum and Dad's bed until my sister came in and got into bed and said, "What are you doing here?" And then I had to tell her that Dad had died. And, you know, she didn't accept it. And it was just sort of not a nice period to go through. Mm. But amazing. I think kids are amazing because they have this sort of resilience. But I think it comes out later on in life in different areas.
Mm. And trauma affects people very differently, especially at a young age. And did you... before we go back to you, Nick, with your sister there, the younger one, did you feel like you had to be more of a father figure than growing up?
Yeah, I think Nick and I sort of took that role on.
Poor thing.
Yeah, poor thing. They've been quite the same since. And actually, we've got a very close family. And I think, you know, having people you can turn to, having people around really helps, assuming you can reach out to them and you're sharing this loss. I think the challenge when people, especially, you know, military guys, when they have this trauma and go back home, is that people can't share, their family can't share that same trauma, whereas Nick and I are very lucky because the whole family, we were sharing that trauma together. We were a group. Mm. And we could all relate to each other, which I think really helps in the long term.
And then the kind of the glimmer we mentioned then, which was yourself, and unbeknown to you, I should imagine. But did you feel that? Did you feel like the family were rallied round?
Yeah, it's kind of weird in hospital because your mind plays tricks. I could not accept that Dad wasn't still around, and I kept expecting him to walk into the ward. And it was quite a humbling experience being in this ward in Whitechapel, you know, with people dying every night. And I mean, it was a pretty horrendous experience because I was in a renal and plastics ward. So every night you'll be a renal patient screaming in pain and then passing away. And it was, but I kept thinking Dad was going to walk down into the ward and go, "Look, I just, you know, I am all right. I just didn't want to upset you," or something like that. I didn't know what, you know, what's amazing is you're pumped full of so many drugs to keep you in this in this semi-coma.
You're as high as a kite, aren't you?
You're high as a kite. But I had the dreams, funnily enough, I had back then. I can still, you know, when you have a dream, you can't remember the next day, can you? You go, "What was that dream I had last night?" I can still remember the dreams I had 25 years ago. There was that vivid, really bizarre. Mm. So it was a really, really difficult time. But we're, again, you know, we've got an older sister as well, who's Sophie, who lives, she lived in Islington at the time, and she was an incredible mainstay as well, really special. You know, she would come in when I started getting a bit better. She came in with food every day. Mm. You know, so you're actually on the mend because she's cooking your lasagna and bringing that in. And then that's where, you know, I really feel for people who were in that ward who didn't have that.
Mm.
And you felt bad. You felt guilty.
And then you got MRSA.
Then I got this super bug. So I was then stuck in a... So what was quite funny, it was... So I'd been in intensive care and I got stuck in this individual room the night I came, the 2 days out of intensive care. This is individual ward. And I thought, this isn't so bad. I've got my own television. I'm in this room. Okay, it's small, but, you know, I can actually... And Giles and our mutually sort of best mate turned up. And the first thing Giles did, he put a page 3 picture on the wall. And then the sister of the ward came in and said, if you're good enough to look at that, you're good enough to go in the main ward. And I was in there for about 24 hours and got stuck in this. So I think, thanks, Jai. So I was stuck in the main ward. But then I got this super bug, this MRSA, which, because I had lots of metalwork and framework in my body, and the bug had just sort of gone in through that.
So that was from the hospital?
That's from the hospital.
That'd gone in, it wasn't from inside out.
Exactly, and that's when Nick and I hatched this plan. We said, look, if you stay in here, you're just going to die, because all this bugs and the food, and we need to get you out of here. So
It was
horrendous. So no disrespect to the hospital, it's just stuck in this
region. But you're stuck in an isolation ward with a load of other people with the same bug.
Mm.
So you can't, I mean, they just have to contain it. So you're stuck in this.
Are you grieving as well?
Well, you're...
Are you too... Are you too?
Well, no, you are. You're trying to mend yourself. You're grieving. You're going through so many different emotions. And you're probably on, you know, you're some kind of detox from all the drugs you're being put on as well. So, but then you're suddenly put on these massively powerful antibiotics. And
so I rocked out one night and said, look, Nick, we've got to go. So we crept out of the hospital. I put Nick in the car. Discharged himself and took him back to Norfolk. And that was the change. Suddenly saw proper improvement. His glint slowly come back and proper baths, proper food. And just that sort of, there is more to life than being stuck in
Whitechapel. But I tell you what was amazing, and it was so humbling, is when you are in hospital, you meet some of the nurses, the male nurses, female nurses, are just incredible. Yeah. You know, they're having to bathe you or the heart. I mean, you've seen it as well. That you cannot quite comprehend what the job these people do. And they have to put up with so much. And they're smiling throughout. They're helping you get better. And you know, you're screaming in pain because you've got your staples everywhere. But they're washing you there. I mean, I have to take my hat off to
them. Our NHS is
phenomenal.
Unbelievable.
It is.
And I've got 3 children. I seriously don't think any of my children would be here if it weren't for the NHS because of the bad. It is.
I know.
It's fantastic. And then recovery wise, was it just at home being looked after, or was the kind of official rehab, physiotherapy? Was that all involved?
This is where the NHS from. For the whole trauma stuff.
Yeah.
They kind of, when you leave hospital, I think discharging myself, they probably said, actually, washing your hands off you now. Physio, I had very little, actually, I have to say. It was more, but my therapy was actually hanging out with Giles and going back, trying to go back to normality and understanding where we are, our life was going to go from there.
But you did have to have copious number of operations, though, didn't you?
I had quite a few. I mean, I remember driving with Giles once and we're driving along and I just learned to drive again. And I was sort of going like this, my hand on the steering wheel. Do you remember this? And I said, Jai, one sec, can you hold the steering wheel? And I was just, this bit of bone started popping out of my mouth. So I started pulling this bone and put it in the sort of the ashtray and then carried on. I mean, it was a weird, but I think as a family, you needed to be together. And I think that was the best sort of form of getting back.
Mm. And apart from being there, what was your role in all this?
He's been a
bit of
fun. The breakout.
Yeah, the breakout doing it. I think it's difficult because the whole family's fallen apart. My mother is obviously totally distressed.
You took a year out of university.
Yeah, so I decided to take a year out of university and go and just be around and be that support. And, you know, all the details of, you know, my father's bank accounts have been shut. You know, all that sort of death stuff that you need to go through whilst also looking after Nick and the rest of my family. So I took that time out, and it's the best thing I could have done.
But it's a big stress on you. It was a huge stress. And I don't think I could underestimate suddenly the stuff you had to deal with for a 20-odd-year-old was really quite full-on.
Yeah, but you had survived. So that sort of, it wasn't, there was always that light. And
was the, was there any, did you feel any blame towards Nick?
No, not at all. It was, flying, and so many father's friends had died in plane crashes, and this we'd been living around it, and it is a risk of flying old planes, and I was flying them as well. So I didn't. What I did really feel is, this sort of stable character in my life, my dad, had disappeared, and how are you going to get over that grief, and do you sink back and feel sorry for yourself, or do you actually say, right, let's make the most of this? And I remember it wasn't long before Dad's death. Dad turned to me once driving in the car and said, look, as a father, I've done my bit now. You guys, you've got the world to go at. I'm not going to add any more value. It's very poignant, those last words, and it's always stuck in my head.
Which is utter rubbish, really, because we could have done with so much more help.
But I think the fact that he had handed over that baton, I had to go and run with that. So what's the point of feeling sorry for yourself in life? But it does, going through trauma hardens you up. And it's not always a good thing to be too hard as well. And but you have to protect yourself.
You do, but not at the cost of others. But having that again, that unit around you where you're almost responsible for each other. When was the first time after the incident where you two flew together, or did you fly together?
It was actually pretty soon. So we got back home and there's a lot of chat, oh, Nick, you'll never want to fly again. And I think Nick was still slightly high at this point. And everyone said, well, that's the end of the flying days. And I said one morning, right, let's go. And we literally sort of went out. And we had this old 1930s Piper Cub, which is a very simple, basic plane. It sort of literally lifted Nick in, and we just went for a little fly. It's a 10-minute flight, and it's the thing about flying. It's incredibly emotional. You're away from everything. You're flying over clouds, over Norfolk beaches, and it's just you're in a different world. And I think it was very therapeutic.
Mindfulness is a real healer of people. That's what we're finding again and again. The military community is very good at looking at new things and not new things but alternative ways of dealing with trauma, and I suppose being or flying is very much mindfulness. You can't think about too much else except flying, and
you've got to have something to take your mind off this stuff. And I think the trauma, the military guys we've been really lucky to work with over the years and who have come back from trauma, it's having a project, having something to take your mind off it. And I suppose with me, it was, I had to look after my mother and my family and do something. I had a reason to do
it. A mission.
A purpose and meaning.
A purpose. I had a real purpose. Whereas I think when you come back from Afghanistan and you've been wounded and you come back and you're discharged from the army, where's your purpose? And that must be awful when you lose that purpose.
And we've covered things like Team Rubicon, and Team Rubicon are a disaster relief organisation, and people could join that. And then there's lots out there, but purpose and meaning are so important. 2002, was that when the business first?
Yeah, so we'd always had this of love of watches and clocks. Our dad had sort of, used to bring them home and we used to try and fix them in the workshop. And we're really aware of this amazing history of British watchmaking. So everyone thinks Swiss made, but turn of the last century, half the world's watches and clocks were being made in the UK. The world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time. 60% of modern mechanical watch, those inventions have come from British watchmakers. And two world wars have basically wiped it out. You know, if we're machining components now to probably 5 microns, humans' hair is 50 microns. So if you can machine a watch, you can machine anything in metal. So World War One, World War Two, Boer War before that, you were making watches. You were basically poached to go and build guns, planes, engines, rifles, etc. Swiss is a neutral country. They weren't building any of that, so they carried on making watches and selling them to the British and the Germans. So our watch industry died out in the sort of late 60s.
So it wasn't the talent that died out, it was the ability to make...
The ability to make it. That talent had drifted, had gone into the
war
machine, effort.
It's all about survival.
It's all about survival. And actually, there was probably more money in making guns and planes at the time than watches. But that talent base was lost. So Nick and I were really aware of this amazing history of British watchmaking. At the time, there were 750 Swiss watch companies, but no British watch company.
Well, no mass manufacturer. There were British, but they're all most artisanal. You know, 5 people making 10 watches a year. Giles and I wanted to really look at bringing manufacture back on a bigger scale.
Even at that early stage in the business?
Well, the long-term game. We couldn't afford to do it early
on. But strategy, you was thinking that far
ahead. Yeah, very much so.
That was the vision.
We wanted to... When you go through something like we'd been through, is this tipping point of actually, look, we could be dead tomorrow. Let's go and do something, one, we really enjoy. That's a real challenge, and it's this long-term vision. And whether you're actually going to make it or not is another thing entirely. But this was this sort of desire, and as much a passion, a hobby, as it was a business. We didn't think it'd be quite so hard to begin with, but
how was the setup then? How did you initially
So Giles and I, but basically the way it happened, we told our wives it'd be a year and a half till we had our first watch. That was our plan. And actually, one of the best rules we ever learned from one of our dear FDs was the 3 times rule. And this 3 times rule is a very important rule in life. Okay, it's 3 times. It always takes 3 times longer. 3 times more expensive, and it's 3 times more difficult than you ever imagined in your sort of initial planning. And that's exactly what happened with us. So it wasn't till 2007, so 5 years later, when we had our first watch available. But we went to Bienn in Switzerland with a blank sheet of canvas and tried to work out how the whole supply chain, how the design process, how it all worked. And we just went there and absorbed. I lived in France for a bit. Giles was going backwards and forwards. We had a little workshop with, 4 people doing these prototypes. And it was, and the whole idea was to produce a watch which was beautifully, beautifully engineered, but a watch that any good watchmaker, irrespective of knowing the brand, could take the back off the watch and go, wow, that is stunning. Yeah. Had to be mechanical, had to be chronometer rated. It was all about the engineering. But even then, we're saying, how do we differentiate ourselves as a brand? And I think one of the key words there was authenticity. There's no point having a, inverted commas, British watch brand if you're not doing stuff on British soil. And so quite soon, about 2 or 3 years when we were up and running, we started hiring and actually training watchmakers in the UK, and that's how it all really started. So every watch now is obviously made and assembled and tested, and lots of our parts made in the UK, which is quite special.
And the story of how the name came about is fairly well documented, but it's got everything to do with planes.
Well, our lives had a lot of planes and a lot of accidents.
Borderline.
We didn't have a watch brand name for probably the first 3 years of that time in Switzerland. It wasn't important to us. And Giles has already highlighted the incredible history we had of British watchmaking on these shores. And it was, we could have gone off and bought any number of brands from the past or just taking them, Harrison.
Revived, you mean?
Yeah, revived. So the first ship's chronometer was made by John Harrison in the 1700s. Now, what was to stop us doing a brand called Harrison or Mudge or Tompion or any of these incredible watchmakers from the past? But the issue is it wasn't us.
It wasn't authentic. It wasn't
you. It wasn't authentic. But a lot of people, Switzerland is full of brands like that. And, It has happened. I think if Harrison had been our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, it would have been a different thing, but he wasn't. So, yeah, for the first 3 years, we didn't have a brand. And when it came to finally, my gosh, we've really got to think about naming it. Our surname is English, so having a British watch brand called English, I think the irony would have been lost on quite a few people. And actually, to trademark the English watch company would have been hard as well. And it came down to probably a couple of years after assuming Giles is my brother, 2 years after our accident, we back on one of our European jaunts flying, this time an old aeroplane. And these old aeroplanes have very low fuel endurance. You know, they last an hour and a half. And this is actually, believe it or not, I know we look very youthful, but this is pre-GPS, really. So you have a watch, a map and a compass, and that was your navigation. So you're consistent, you know, all the time looking at roads and railways and rivers, and that's how you navigate it. This weather, we should have never been flying in this particular day, and we ended up getting lost, basically, and putting it down in a pea field, this airplane, because we had literally 5 minutes of fuel left. If you do that in America or you do that in the UK, you apologise to the farm and you buy a bottle of whiskey or something. In France, it's very bureaucratic and it's illegal. The airplane gets impounded and it's there's endless stories online you can find of people landing in France and the bureaucracy, you know, weeks of, you know, is it safe to take off? No, it's not. Take your airplane to an airfield. And so we landed there knowing the repercussions, but it was better to be alive, obviously, knowing our history. Giles went.
It's previous. Yeah.
So we landed there. Giles hitchhiked with a very good-looking girl to try and get some fuel whilst I was left in this field. And actually, then this guy approached. And we thought, oh, no, this is going to be the start of it. And this guy said, look, why don't you put the... It was raining, which is a good indication of why we shouldn't have been flying. Put the airplane in his barn. And Giles came back and trying to think, oh, my gosh, where's Nick gone? And I can't let Giles come in. And we, this guy was amazing. And the point was, had our father lived for another 30 years, late 70s was this guy's age, who is into mechanical things like our father, and it'd have lots of fun things stuck in his barn and workshop, was into aircraft and all the sort of stuff we were into. And his name was Anton Bremont. So that's where it meant something to us. It was a name we felt would suit a watch, and it wasn't about stealing someone else's history. So that's how...
Was he aware that you used his name?
Well, he is in his late 70s, so he knew we were doing prototype watches, but sadly never saw the launch of the brand.
We did tell him we're going to... Yeah, we said, look, we're not going to associate this with you in any way, but we love the name Bremont. Ah, crazy Englishman. That was sort of the answer. And that's the story of the name.
Let's go to August now, 2013.
recurring theme
one,
here.
One crash the other, exactly, yeah.
Do not get in a plane with these.
Yeah, that's true.
If you ever want to come flying, you're more than welcome.
Let's do a competition through your listeners.
Yeah. 1930s biplane, is that right?
Yes, it was a gypsy moth, which we always loved. It's the most beautiful sort of de Havilland gypsy moth, and Amy Johnson flew to Australia. Sir Francis Chichester flew to Australia and back. It's an amazing sort of historical aircraft, which absolutely loved this plane, most stunning thing. And yeah, one beautiful August day, it all went horribly wrong for me as well.
Because there was you was flying, but you had a family friend.
Good one, Joy. So I had my godson in the plane with me, called Ollie Nuttall, a lovely kid, and I wasn't far from my house, and I was flying over this. National Trust property in Northamptonshire, and I was in a tight turn and the engine stopped on me, which is normally fine. You'd sort of level out and glide in somewhere. The problem was it put me into a spin and I was only about 800 feet, so I was very low.
What kind of spin?
So
tail to the front?
No, it's sort of nose down, and you sort of spin like a sycamore leaf.
Still going forward.
Still going forward, but vertically. And I got it out of it, but I was, you know, on a hillside with this National Trust property below me, a lake, a woodland.
Trees, cows,
general public. So there was nowhere for me to go. So I just did a very heavy landing. It stopped within about a foot. And the whole plane just crumpled up underneath.
How do you call it a light landing.
The whole plane is just made of wood. So it all just sort of crumpled underneath me. And my head went into the cockpit. Luckily, I was wearing a helmet, which often I didn't do. But I knocked myself out anyway. And then came to, and my first thought was, I've killed my godson. Because you do. And but very quickly, I heard him screaming. I thought, oh, God, that's so good. He's screaming. Yeah. That means at least he's alive. But I had smashed myself pretty badly. I knew my back just didn't feel right, and my legs all crushed underneath the plane. And then my sort of journey started, and which was luckily, you know, we mentioned air ambulance earlier.
We had an account by then.
We had a camp. Interesting. If you have a crash, do it near National Trust property, because they had all their health and safety sorted, so they put out the right calls. And often in plane crashes, the air ambulance get there pretty quickly because it registers. So it was Coventry air ambulance who came out, and it was then, I think, about an hour and a half of me being cut out of the plane and slowly put on a stretcher and taken off to Coventry. And I had broken my back in three places, chipped my knees and broke my ankle and nose and a few other bits. But actually the worst, I broke my coccyx as well, which, that's just the worst.
You're going around that donut cushion for about 6 months.
So it was serious but not catastrophic.
The big concern was, had I done my spinal cord and was I going to be paralysed? It was probably, you know, 4 or 5 hours later on, after having all my scans, they thought I'd be okay. Mm. And then it was straight into the, you know, recuperation period.
Ollie behind you, what was...
So he... he smashed his arms and legs up pretty bad, and he got some really bad cuts. So was in quite a bad way, but luckily no spinal injuries for him.
Or no head or anything.
No head. He slashed himself up pretty badly and broke a few bones.
But he now uses it for pulling the girls at school, doesn't he?
I think it's a really good war story, isn't it? Well, let me tell you about the plane crash I was in. Where they're discussing scars.
The shark attack.
It was actually a shark attack, yeah. So I think he's used it for that. But I think with all this sort of stuff, it's you go through the crash. It's the devastation it causes around you.
Well, what was your mum like? Yeah, in this.
Well, I had to call her up.
Yeah, you had.
So it was like a complete
role reversal.
So I got this call. I was in Henley at a workshop, and I just got a call from, I think it was your brother-in-law, or Jimmy, the father of the godson. Mm. So just said there's been an accident, horrible accident. The air ambulance has just taken Charles to Coventry. And I went, you're joking. And you just can't quite believe. It is impossible to comprehend that this is happening again. Mm. So again, I had to do the thing. And I rang my mother up and I said, Mum, there's been a bit of an accident. Everything's fine. But Charles has been airlifted to, and of course, trying to talk to your mother at that point. She's not really listening. She's just in in hysterics at that point because she's lost her lost her husband, first son smashed himself up, now the second son is, and she can't quite believe it. But I think fairly soon, you know, within hours, as Giles said, we knew that he would be okay. It was just a road to recovery rather than. But again, it was the difficult thing was, you know, Ollie in the airplane, and we all felt, you know, very responsible for that as well. And
it has been documented that your incredible skill not only saved your life but saved his life as well. I know that you was in the situation. You put yourself in the situation.
That, yeah,
but you
so take. I think it's, you can look at it both ways.
But the skill wasn't flying and what letting his wife see it happen. That was the spot where he let himself down.
I think I let myself down many, many places.
Because his wife
there.
Saw the whole
Listen,
thing.
Listen, really? It was. I'm actually, the hardest thing for all has been my wife, because I met her 3 months before Dad died. And then she lived through this plane crash.
She's not massively into flying.
No, flying is so she's rather negative towards flying at this stage. But I think that whole recuperation that time, it just takes a long time, and your frustrations and you know you're kept in bed for 3 months lying flat. You lose basically every single bit of muscle you've got, and you've got a business that needs to be run and
which suddenly went much better when he wasn't around. It's
just, leaving Nick to run it was just sort of terrifying. So it does make you look at life in a very different way, and to live through both these crashes, it's you do want to live life every day. You really do.
But you talk about, you know, living life and going out and doing things, and we'll get onto some of the military stuff in a second. But does that also include your drive for business as well, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
So your drive in achieving an exceptional business, whether that's the model or whether that's the people you involve with. It seems very, you know, I was at your townhouse a few weeks ago. It's very much like a family feel to it.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that happens. One is your propensity to risk changes. So suddenly this whole adage of life is short really does resonate, and Giles and I are far more willing to accept, actually, let's just do it, bugger it, let's go off and do that, when perhaps you may have had, you know, reason to not do that. We're looking, instead of doing a return on investment thing all the whole time and saying, right, this money's got to have a payback over 3 years, and if it's not, you know, what is the upside? What is the upside? Giles's and I view is very much Nick, what is the downside of doing this? And it's a very, you turn it on your head, but it's a very big thought change, you know, looking at the downside rather than the upside. So we do go off and do things perhaps that we wouldn't have done beforehand. And I think it has played a big role in.
Yeah, and I think you're sort of, you realise you've got to work hard. And I think, probably, you know, post dad and we learnt, none of this comes easy. You've got to work really hard. But if you're enjoying what you're doing, then you can do some really special things. Mm. If you're not enjoying it in life, then you've got to change what you're doing. And that's always the challenge. It's getting that balance right.
But also you hit the nail on the head with, when you came to townhouse, you know, it feels like a bit of a family. We quickly realised that actually we only want to work with nice people.
Oh, everyone was really nice.
Because life is this whole thing, life's a little short. Why do you want to work with anyone who's less than good fun? And I think the whole Bremel family feel like, you've met a number of our ambassadors, a number of people who...
Mm. Well, our friends were...
Yeah, you know them all. Exactly.
And you would want good guys around you, don't you?
Yeah, of course you do.
Who have the right morals and the right values. And
Brian Wood's a bit dodgy.
Yeah.
So is Jordan. Yeah. Apart from them two.
Apart from those two.
What's he done?
Yeah, we're slightly screwed up there. Yeah.
So let's lead on to the military stuff. And... Oh, the ambassador stuff, really. A lot of your ambassadors are military or from that military community. And what is it? Because you've also entered into a partnership with the MOD, which honours the armed forces.
Yeah.
Well,
But what's all that about? Why are you in that So why is that important to you?
First of all, it happened very organically over here. You know, a chunk of Bremel's business is making for military units around the world, and we've done many, many, many of those. And it's something we're incredibly proud of. And we've got a whole unit just doing nothing but that within Bremel. But you immediately begin to meet some wonderful people through that. And it's happened that the various unit you'll work with, and you'll meet someone nice who's doing something interesting. It might be in the Marines with, you know, Expedition 5, these guys going off and who've suffered, you know, some horrific things with the pulp on the PTSD side, but they're off doing interesting adventures as a result, as a way of therapy. And if we can help, if we can get involved, we're very keen to do that. And, you know, we try and employ ex-military people if we can. So we've got this Armed Forces Covenant, which we've worked towards over a number of years. But it has been because, you know, we've just met Invictus Games and things like that. We have just met some incredible individuals, who men and women, who have, I think what we've done and what we are doing resonates with them as it does the other way around.
I think
it?
we've got total respect for people in the military, and Nick and I personally see them as heroes, what they go out and do. And I think part of that messaging, if the rest of the UK of our clients, we can pitch that as a message. They're risking their lives for us. And I think they're inspirational, they're physically amazing, their approach to life, I think just commands respect, and we've always as a business respected that. And I think if you've got ambassadors, yes, we work with a lot of non-military people as well, but I think they are brilliant ambassadors. But that whole military space is, you know, I love it when you're in America and, you know, first class passengers and anyone from the military get on the plane first type approach. It's not like that in the UK, but it should be. And if Bremel can wave our little flag for the military, then we want to do
that. I think there's a few things there. You know, the Armed Forces Covenant has gone a long way in providing safe, secure environments for people to work in, and especially when you get to like the silver and then the gold awards, or the people that mean it, like you guys, they mean what you say with employment and opportunity. And then we look at adversity. We look at things like empathy and other values and traits that a lot of our military community has, especially those that have experienced conflict and trauma. And you come off the back end of that, and we speak about growth, which we've talked about today with you guys. Maybe you weren't aware of it, but how have you grown because of these accidents and the situations you've been put into? And you're now coming to a point where you're providing assistance and guidance and partnerships with other people that have experienced this growth because of trauma as well. I think that they're the key fundamentals for me. And your ambassadors typify that as well. You know, you look at people like Foxy or O'Brien or Jordan, and what are they doing now? They're not just sat back doing nothing for people. They're giving a lot.
Seriously giving back. And it's very easy for them to have sat back and not do that, but they haven't. And I think we can all learn from that. And from Brown's perspective, if we can help any of these guys by giving them a platform to a market they haven't been promoting to, then we can help give something back to these people as well.
So what is the impact of this? So we've just mentioned Invictus there. So I know you guys were an avid, a really keen supporter of Invictus, Walking with the Wounded,
which is
the Endeavour Fund.
Yeah.
What have you done in the past with?
So we've done things like Walking with the Wounded. We did a long time ago. That's quite a few years ago, wasn't it? With
the South Pole trip.
Yeah, yeah. South Pole and other areas there, and that was quite special seeing these. And that was one of the first things I think we got involved with, which was a proper project where you saw these amputees and other guys and girls going off to do an incredible adventure where they were walking hundreds of miles towards the North Pole with. What they did then, and obviously Harry being involved, Prince Harry, and it suddenly got this awareness out there a little bit, which was fantastic. Then Invictus came along, and then we've done watches over the years which were very much charitably based. So, you know, when it was the RAF 100, we worked with the RAF Association to sort of raise money for them, and these little bits here and there, and it's sort of grown. And and then, as I said, this Armed Forces Covenant is a really lovely sort of, I suppose, nod in the right direction of where we want to head, and as a business, how we sort of view the military.
Yeah, and I think on the Invictus side, it's supporting the British team, and we've created this bracelet that all the proceeds go to charity on that. And
how do we get the bracelet?
Online, so there's a new one which will be coming out in, I think, July, which is Invictus Bramall bracelet, which did very well. So we'll be pushing that again. And I think it's telling some of the stories of the athletes and communicating that to an audience that isn't hearing those stories.
And then, with, you know, on the ambassador side, you do have these incredible individuals, male and female, who come out, have, I mean, don't take this the wrong way, but I think they come out and they, they're semi-institutionalized. You know, you've lived 15, 20 years of your life in the military, and we see it the same with athletes. And they come out and they've been training for 15 years. They're doing nothing but 6 days a week training. Mm-hmm. And they come out and go, my gosh, this is Civvy Street. You know, what am I going to do now? And we try and help, and we have helped, you know, where we can with, it might be expeditions, it might be sort of pointers in the right direction, it might be employment, it might be, and it's very, very rewarding. So, you know, it might be NIMS going off and climbing these, you know, 14, 8,000 metre peaks. And, you know, on their face of it, it seems quite crazy, but they need a bit of direction. They need a bit of help. They need, and if we can do that, it feels wonderful.
Really, and also the network as well.
They all help each other.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You're off the back of, you know, NIMS, his Twitter account was one. Now it's growing and growing because off the back of people like Foxy and I know, I don't think Ant's part of you guys, but, you know, Ant jumps. So there is a community there that then promote each other and help
Everyone
each other.
Everyone promotes and helps.
And they've all become really good friends. So you'll have, you know, the Ben Saunders, the Jake Mayers, these incredible mountaineers and explorers and polar explorers giving their advice to Expedition 5. You know, if you're crossing Greenland, you know, Ben's done more polar miles than virtually ever any other individual on the planet. You know, take this pointer. You know, this is worth it.
Alex Gregory is helping Jordan with his rowing.
Mm. You know, Alex Gregory's got 2 gold medals at the Olympics. You know, so suddenly it's and they've become a really lovely. I mean, the difficulty for Bremont is expanding it in the same way overseas. You know, we're in a few different countries we sell, but it's so easy to do it on your home turf. It's how do you replicate that in the States? And we do a lot of military in the States. It's a huge part of our business, but we're not there to kind of
Again, it goes back those values that you were brought up with, you know, that authenticity. But you just don't go to everything. You know, you guys are everything to everybody.
We don't.
But you're
a lot
a lot of people. I think that's.
I think that's a very good point. I think we realised quite early on, and you know, Nick and I do all the design of our watches. Is if you try and appease everyone and appeal to everyone, you end up not appealing to anyone, and your designs become very nondescript. And this is who Bremont is, and it's basically all the stuff that Nick and I are into, and you hope other people like that as well. Now, you know, we're selling high end luxury watches; they cost a lot to build these watches. Does that really appeal? Do we sell watches off the back of all the things we do? Well, I'm not. Probably doesn't always work, but these are passions that Nick and I feel quite strongly about, and we've never had the marketing investment to put ads everywhere, and so it's this sort of subtle marketing approach that we have grown, because you know, all of our cash goes into training and buying CNC machines to machine bits of metal in Henley, so it's. We've had to take a fresh approach to the, you know, our competitors are turning over, you know, £500 million. I mean, they're massive businesses, whereas we're not. And often people think we're considerably larger than we are, and we're, you know, we're making so much profit that we can just give it out everywhere. Mm. Sadly, it's not the case. I've got Nick working, who sort of spends a lot. But
And also, we have to look after Giles, who wouldn't find employment anywhere else. So
it sounds like you need. There's this cycle of aircraft that keep going through your hangars as well.
Yeah. there's a lot of restoration.
It's a lot of restoration costs going on.
Yeah. Gentlemen, we're going to wrap it up. I really, really do appreciate your time coming in. I think it's going to affect a lot of people. I think there's a lot of value in that conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. And really congratulations on what you're doing as well. It's amazing.
Yeah. Tony, sorry. Thank you.
We'll leave it there.